Hey, you guys, welcome back to Flickers of Fear, talking about a stone cold classic on this episode. So this is the 1967 movie Wait Until Dark. And this was another movie that I had actually sought out as a kid in the 1980s because kind of the third act of it, which is, you know, very, very famously like a really tense sequence, got mentioned very favorably in the Stephen King book Dance Macabre, which I brought up many, many other times on this channel. So I had wanted to see it back then, and I remembered like really, really loving it. I probably saw it when I was 13, 14 years old, something like that. So I was actually really excited to revisit it for this series, since I hadn't seen it since then that I can remember. And I have to say that I'm very happy to report that this movie absolutely holds up. In my opinion, I think it's one of the best, like easily one of the most effective thrillers like of all time. Now, interestingly, like the 2006 movie Bug that I just discussed a few days ago, which was directed by William Friedkin, Wait Until Dark was also an adaptation of a successful stage play that takes place almost entirely in one location, like one room, one apartment. No, I did not intentionally review two based on a play movies in the same week on purpose, unless my subconscious is smarter than I am, which, you know, that's a possibility, I suppose. But I didn't mean to do it, like at least consciously. Now, the stage production this time around of Wait Until Dark was written by Frederick Knott, who didn't write a lot of plays like over his career, but he also wrote, I mean, you really don't have to write that many if you wrote like one or two really, really good ones, which this guy did. The other one that he's known for other than this one is the 1952 play Dial M for Murder, which of course was made into the classic Alfred Hitchcock film from 1954. Now, the film adaptation of Wait Until Dark was directed by none other than Terrence Young, who at this point was best known for directing three, count them, three James Bond films, Dr. No from 1962, From Russia with Love from 1963, and Thunderball from 1965. Now, in this stage version of Wait Until Dark, at least like the widely seen like a Broadway version, Lee Remick actually starred in the main role. She was in a shit ton of stuff, but I think most horror nerds like me recognize her as Damien's mom from The Omen from 1976. But yeah, she was in the stage version. However, the producer of the movie, it's Mel Ferrer? It's Ferrer, right? I mean, I've heard it pronounced like lots of different ways. I know the guy's name, like he's famous, but it's like I keep hearing it, but I'm just gonna say that. But he was the producer on this, and he had actually specifically obtained the rights to Frederick Knott's play as a vehicle for Audrey Hepburn, who was then his wife. He wanted her to be able to kind of show off like how wide her range was, like her acting chops. Now, the hell of that was, though, that Mel and Audrey Hepburn were in the midst of divorcing when this movie was being shot. So obviously there was a lot of personal stress that Audrey Hepburn was going through, and this role was kind of like demanding, both emotionally and a bit physically as well. So she was like not having a good time, and she actually ended up losing 15 pounds like from the stress and stuff like that. And if you've seen Audrey Hepburn, she can't really afford to lose 15 pounds anywhere. She is a tiny, tiny woman. So she looks very, very fragile in this movie, but in a way I think that kind of, I know that's terrible and you don't want that to happen to anybody, but it really did kind of like inform her character and make her seem, like I said, more fragile, more vulnerable, and so that kind of made you like sympathize with her all the more. And I have to say that her performance in this is incredible. She really rose to the challenge. This actually earned her her fifth Oscar nomination, although I will say too that I think that was the last Oscar nomination that she bought after this movie, though. I think she kind of like semi-retired. I don't think she was in another movie for like another decade after this, like maybe until like the mid to late 70s, if I'm remembering correctly. So yeah, it kind of did a little bit of a number on her, but like I said, she got a Academy Award nomination, and deservedly so, because she's fucking great in this. So at the very beginning of the movie, we meet this woman named Lisa, who's played by Samantha Jones. And she's picking up this antique doll, which this older guy is like sewing all these little packets of heroin into it, like into the stuffing. Now, incidentally, although Lisa is referred to in the stage play, she never appears as an actual character. So this whole opening sequence, like with her picking up the drugs and going to the airport and everything like that, is a film only addition. Like in the play, obviously, because the play, you know, is by necessity kind of set in one location, they didn't really have the wherewithal to do like all of these bigger things like that. So all this opening thing with like the airport and her getting the doll and everything like that does not happen in the play. So after a few moments, we surmise that Lisa is obviously a drug mule and she's smuggling all this heroin, which is a lot. I'm not up on heroin, so I don't really know like how expensive that is. It must be really expensive because everybody's trying to get it. But, you know, so I don't know. But she's smuggling this heroin into New York City from Montreal. Upon arriving at the airport, though, she starts to become really, really nervous when she sees this kind of intimidating-looking, beatniky-looking dude who's, like, watching her, and she decides that she's gonna ditch the drugs. So she ends up pawning the doll off on the stranger that she met on the plane. Now, this stranger is a photographer named Sam Hendricks, who's played by Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., and she basically gives him some kind of like cock and bull story about, oh, this doll is a present for my niece, but then I forgot to get my other niece something and they're going to get jealous. So can you just hang on to this for a little bit and then like give me your address and I'll come over later and pick it up and all this other kind of stuff. And he's just like, what? Okay, whatever. And he just like sticks it in his luggage and doesn't really think about it anymore. So after that whole exchange, like Lisa gets kind of roughly whisked away by the beatniky intimidating looking man who didn't actually see that whole doll exchange, or so we're led to believe. Now, sometime later, this beatniky intimidating man, who actually turns out to be criminal mastermind Harry Rote, who's played by Alan Arkin, who is fantastic in this, he summons two of his little criminal associates to this kind of small, like, cellar-level apartment in Greenwich Village in New York City. These two associates are Mike, who's played by Richard Crenna, and Carlino, who's played by Jack Weston. Now, Rote tells these two guys, he summoned them, I'm assuming, because they're really good, like, con men, you know what I mean? They run, like, long cons on people. So he basically tells them, hey, this is Lisa's place, and this doll that has all this heroin in it is somewhere in this apartment, and I need you guys' help to find out where she stashed it. Soon enough, though, like, while Mike and Carlino are doing the search, they realize that this is actually not Lisa's place at all. And what's even worse than that is that they find Lisa dead in a locked closet. So it's only then that they figure out that Rote has killed Lisa and then has kind of like fooled them, or essentially like blackmailed them into helping him out. Because he's like, hey, you know, Lisa's dead in this apartment and you motherfuckers touched every single thing in here. You know, and he's like, hey, I've got gloves on. I was thinking ahead. Like, they were just helping him look for the doll. They thought it was Lisa's place. They found it wasn't, but it was too late then. And he's like, you're never going to be able to, like, wipe down this whole entire place or remember everything that you touched. Yeah, so he's like, so obviously if I leave Lisa's body in here and I call the cops, then they're going to want to find you guys because your fingerprints are already on file and blah, blah, blah. So they've basically been forced not only into helping Rote, like, dump the body, but they also kind of get roped into this scheme that Rote has cooked up in order to find out where the doll is. Now, he says, I've searched this entire apartment and I can't find the doll. So he reasons that the doll has to be in this little safe that's in the living room. And he can't get it open. So he's pretty much devised this really complicated charade in order to get into the safe, and he needs these two guys' particular set of skills, like, to help him out with this plan. So obviously, it turns out that this apartment actually belongs to the photographer, Sam Hendricks, the guy that Lisa met on the plane and gave the doll to. Now, obviously, he is just like a completely uninvolved party. He just ended up with this doll because, like I said, she met him on the plane and was like, here, take this. And he's just like, okay, whatever. So he doesn't know anything that's going on. Now, Sam, furthermore, is married to a woman named Susie, played by the aforementioned Audrey Hepburn. Now, Susie's character, she was in a car accident the year before, and she went blind, like she lost her sight in the accident. So she's still, so her disability is very recent and she's still kind of trying to adapt to it. Now she is very determined But she still kind of has some difficulties, like, navigating the world, because, like I said, she's not really used to it yet. Now, she does have some help with some tasks, like grocery shopping and stuff like that, from this bratty preteen that lives upstairs named Gloria, but her relatively new husband is encouraging her, sometimes in a dickish way, I think, like, to be as self-reliant as possible. She's also going to blind school to kind of teach her how to adjust. Now, the interesting thing, like I said, is that I kind of feel like there's a little bit of thing going on here with Sam, because Sam, he met her after the accident, because there's a thing where she tells the story about, like, she was still adapting to her blindness. She hadn't been blind very long, and she almost apparently, like, walked into the road and got hit by a bus or something like that, and, like, Sam saved her. And so then subsequently they had, like, kind of a whirlwind romance, and then they got married. So I don't really know if there's some kind of, and Sam, like I said, really sort of, I don't know if he's necessarily pushing her, but you could say that he's, like, he has faith that she'll, you know, that she's determined enough, like, to get her shit together, so he doesn't want to coddle her. It does come across a little bit as him being just, like, an asshole sometimes, but, you know, it's like, she'll drop something, and she'll be like, hey, can I have a hint, like, where it's at? And he's like, you'll find it, like, kind of making her crawl around on the floor, like, to find it and stuff. So I don't know, like I said, I can kind of see where he's coming from, but he kind of comes across a little gruff about it. But, you know, there's that whole thing too. And I don't know, I think that she has a little bit in the beginning of the movie, has a little bit of, I don't know if I'd go so far as to, like, call it codependence, but she is kind of, like, dependent on him, particularly because he saved her life. And so I think there's a little bit of that going on too. Like I said, it's not overt, but that was kind of, like, the vibe that I got. So pretty much, like, the main, after all of this is established and set up, like, the main meat of the story is involving these three criminals, Mike and Carlino and Rote, and their really, really horrible, like, treacherous plan to take advantage of Susie's blindness in order to get her to open the safe where they think the doll is. So they go, I mean, it's a pretty elaborate scheme. They concoct this kind of phony, faraway photo shoot, like in Asbury Park or something like that, which that's New Jersey, right? Isn't that New Jersey? I know that from Bruce Springsteen. But you know what I mean? I don't know. I've only been in New Jersey once in my whole entire life. So they concoct this kind of, like, phony thing. Like, oh, they set up a model and everything who doesn't show up. And then he has to wait. And it's, like, really far away from the apartment. So he's going to be out of the apartment. So she's going to be the only one there. And so after that's all taken care of, then they put this, like, elaborate ruse into action. Like, Mike, Richard Crenna's character, he takes on the good guy role, which is, that was kind of one thing. And like I said, I don't even think this is a weakness, but Richard Crenna, I mean, he was in everything, like, in the 60s and 70s. I feel like he was in all the movies, but I kind of feel like he always played a good guy. So it was, like, really interesting to see him play a villain in this, but he is the most sympathetic of the villains, because it seems like Rote, Alan Arkin's character, I mean, he's just straight up evil and just a cold-blooded motherfucker, whereas the other two are also criminals, but they at least still have, like, some humanity to them. So it kind of, I guess because I'm so used to seeing Richard Crenna, like, in good guy roles, it was really hard to see him as a villain. So, and I don't know, like, the movie almost kind of plays into that a little bit, because the role that he's playing is like, hey, I'm the good guy. And then, like, when the other two guys that are, like, in on the shit are trying to, like, you know, threaten her and things like that, he's like, hey, you knock that off. You know what I mean? So they have, like, this whole kind of thing going on. So he kind of comes in first and pretends to be, like, an old buddy of Sam's, like, her husband's, like, from the Marines. And he basically starts acting, like, as the plan unfolds, he starts acting as, like, the confidant and the protector. Like, you know, I'm friends with your husband, and he pretends to know all this stuff. Because, like, you know, she hasn't been married to Sam very long, so she doesn't know that much about him. He even, like, takes advantage of her being blind, and, you know, because Sam's a photographer, and he's like, oh, look, there's a picture of me on the wall, because he knows she can't see it, you know what I mean? So there's that, you know, it's kind of shitty, but there's that whole thing. Carlino, the other guy, he pretends to be a cop. His whole thing is he's investigating the mysterious death of this woman who was found dumped, like, in an alley or something like that, not too far away from the apartment. Now, obviously, we know that this is Lisa, who Rote has killed, but they just dumped her there, making it look like, ooh, it's a, you know, somebody else. And what they're trying to do, like, Carlino's cop character, he's trying to persuade Susie that her husband Sam was having an affair with Lisa and maybe like bumped her off. He's like, I don't know if I believe that, but the cops might believe that. So I need you to help me out, like, you know, clear your husband's name. So they're coming at it from that angle too. Now, Rote, Alan Arkin's character, he plays, like, multiple roles. Like, the main one probably pretending to be Lisa's jealous husband, which sort of, like, bolsters the narrative that they're trying to push off on her that her husband Sam was having an affair with this woman and possibly maybe killed her. So because Susie can't see them or see what's going on around her, like, if they, for example, like, if they tell her, hey, there's a cop car parked outside, she just kind of has to take their word for it. So... yeah, so she kind of has to take everything at face value because she can't really see what's going on. But as the story goes on, her resourcefulness, like the fact that her hearing is getting better, like things like that, and she's like super, super smart too. Also, it kind of like, as it goes along, helps her realize that the danger that she's actually in from these guys, and ultimately kind of helps her fight back against these attackers who have underestimated her, like thinking that she's just this little vulnerable blind woman. So, I mean, Wait Until Dark really benefits immensely from it's, it has a very, very tight narrative. It's like really well plotted. It has like a really claustrophobic atmosphere. Like I said, almost all of it takes place in this one very small Greenwich Village apartment with only a few scenes outside of that. All the acting is terrific, really, really good. The score by Henry Mancini is actually really good as well. And I think one of the things that helps too is that Audrey Hepburn, as an actress, she's just comes across like so sweet and so vulnerable. And then the fact that she's blind as well. So you kind of feel like this instant affinity with her. And you kind of, it's weird because you kind of get mad when, as you're watching like these three hoods, like taking advantage of her disability, like for their own evil ends, just to get this doll that's filled with heroin, is like really, really maddening. Cause it's almost like, and I've seen some reviewers be like, man, leave Audrey Hepburn alone. You know what I mean? So I think the fact that she's just this tiny bird-like, like sweet little woman, and then the fact that they made her blind, and that these like these three guys are like in her apartment, and like she can't see them, and she like senses somebody's in there, but like she can't like tell, and it's like really, really like nail biting like to watch. So, and you really also can't help but root for her when she kind of twigs onto what's going on and then uses her considerable intelligence to start giving them some pushback. Now, even though this isn't a straight up horror movie per se, the final 20 minutes or so is really kind of like a masterclass in scary suspense building and is easily one of the most terrifying sequences ever put on film. And like I said, you watch any top 100 like scariest horror scenes or something like that, I can almost guarantee that this is going to be on there, and for very good reason. So at the end, like, it's come down to the final battle between Susie and Rote. And Susie, I mean, knows that she's outmatched, so she pretty brilliantly levels the playing field. And it's like, I have to say, because I was like, I probably wouldn't have thought of doing this, but, you know, good for her. But she levels the playing field by knocking out every single light in the apartment, like breaking all the lights, so that Rote will be just as blind as she is. So she has a chance. She has to give him, like, the same handicap that she has. Now, in the theatrical run of Wait Until Dark back in 1967, so the story goes, the theater owners were actually instructed to turn off all the lights in the auditorium, I guess within legal boundaries or whatever, during this sequence, because the sequence of the movie is completely black. There is no light, no nothing, and all you can hear is like breathing and dialogue and shit like that. So when you're in the theater, and if you were just plunged into this ultimate darkness, and then like the screen is also dark, and all you can hear is like their dialogue and their breathing, and it's like really, really tense. So it's kind of putting you in the same situation as Susie. Like, there's somebody in this tiny apartment that wants to kill you, and you can't fucking see them, and you don't know if they can see you because you're blind and you can't see. So it's like, it's terrifying, terrifying. And it's like just really genius. I hesitate to call it a gimmick because that sounds reductive. I mean, I guess it kind of is, but it's just really, really well done. If it's a gimmick, it's a fucking great one. And even nowadays, it works brilliantly. I think it's like really, really cool. Have to say though, although Susie does forget one single light. But in all fairness, most of us probably would have forgotten it as well, so I'm not going to, like, give her too much hassle about that. But she is actually able to kind of win the day just through her determination and her ingenuity and stuff like that. So if you're into thrillers at all and have somehow not seen Wait Until Dark, please do yourself a favor and get on it. It's one of the best examples of the thriller genre and has, I mean, in my opinion, has not dated at all. It just has this great sense of unease and just potential menace through the whole entire runtime. Audrey Hepburn is, like, so great. She's just so sympathetic, and she just gets you invested immediately and, like, pulling for her the whole time. You're like, oh, no, oh, my God, like, the poor, you know what I mean, as all of this shit is, like, happening around her. Alan Arkin, I have to say, is also amazing as Roach, who's just, like, just this coolly malevolent motherfucker, and just he's just the fucking worst, but he's so great, and you can tell that he's, like, really having fun, like, with this role. Like, he's just really, like, making a meal of it, and it's great. Honestly, like, the last part of this with, like, the two actors just, like, matching wits in this tiny, like, dark apartment is just, I mean, you're just, like, white knuckling it the whole time. It's just really, really good. I mean, this one is a classic for a reason, and it's just an easy recommend if you like thrillers or if you like any movies from this time period or anything. I mean, this is definitely one that everybody should see because it's great. So that'll do it for this Flickers of Fear. I will see you guys again on the next one. Bye.